Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. The top story today, in fact, the top story around the world is there a breakthrough in the Korean situation? All of a sudden, we have the leaders of North Korea and South Korea meeting for the first time in decades under the circumstances where denuclearization is on the table. And soon, President Donald Trump will meet with Kim Jong-un considering the possibility of denuclearizing the entire Korean Peninsula. This was once thought to be impossible, but the question is it an illusion? What are the stumbling blocks that face us as we entertain the possibility of a denuclearized Korean Peninsula? And then we're going to talk about outer space. NASA is launching the InSight space probe to Mars, which will reach Mars around November 26, if all goes well. And the question is, what are we going to learn from this billion-dollar probe that's going to be shot to the planet Mars? We've already mapped the surface of Mars. We know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the surface of the Earth, in fact, because most of the Earth is covered with water. Mars, of course, is a frozen desert. So the question is, what more can we do? Well, we'll find out in a moment. And also, DNA is in the news once again. This time we had this rather spectacular find that using familiar DNA, authorities in California were able to arrest a suspect being the Golden State Killer. Is this new technique of familiar DNA? And the question is, what about, well, privacy concerns for people who are not mass murderers and not mass rapists? And then we'll say a few things about what President Donald Trump has mused about, and that is a space force, not an air force, not an army, not the Marines, not the Coast Guard, but a space force. That is the militarization of outer space. So we'll talk about the pros and cons, given the fact that there is the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which the United States signed, but there are also hidden, unforeseen blowbacks if you begin to militarize outer space. Well, let's begin with some of the top stories of the past week. The top story around the world is the sudden thaw in relations between North Korea and South Korea. And the question is, does this mean that we may have an enduring peace? Well, you have to realize that we're going through cycles, cycles in which the North Koreans seem to be warming up to the South, initiating relations with the South, but at the same time building up its nuclear weapon stockpiles, and then the whole thing collapses and we start all over again. So some people say it's a charade, but let's take a look at what's on the table. What's on the table is something that hasn't been discussed for a long time, and that is the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Well, first of all, you have to realize what a potential breakthrough this might be, but it might also be a mirage. First of all, there's been a stalemate ever since the Korean War back in the 1950s, because of the fact that, first of all, North Korea can attack Seoul, the South Korean capital, within a matter of hours after the outbreak of hostilities. It could literally destroy the productive capabilities of the South in a matter of days with artillery and troops. Now, the U.S. stations troops in South Korea as a firewall, but there's no doubt that the North Korean military, using troops and artillery, could overwhelm most of the South Korean forces. And then a long war will be dragged out, possibly leading to the use of nuclear weapons. So, well, wargaming shows that there's no winner. We've known that for decades, and that is creating a certain uneasy hostility, but stalemate, between North Korea and South Korea. Now the situation has changed dramatically in the last few years. North Korea, it's estimated, has between 20 to 60 atomic bombs. And the question is, are they capable of hitting the United States from North Korea? Well, what's entirely new is the fact that the North has been testing ICBM technology. They shoot them more or less straight up, coming down straight down, so they don't go over the United States, initiating a war. However, if you then slant the trajectory of the missile toward the United States, you realize that, yes, indeed, they can hit the United States with an ICBM. But, of course, that's not everything. First of all, you have to guarantee accuracy. It's not enough to simply point an ICBM that could reach the continental United States. Second of all, you have to survive reentry. Even if it is pointed directly at the United States, maybe the missile will burn up, disintegrate, and be useless as a military weapon. In fact, the last ICBM that was tested apparently broke up before impact. So at the present time, the North Koreans have not demonstrated the ability to reliably hit the United States. And as President Donald Trump has said, that is the red line. The red line is when the North Koreans can reliably hit the United States with their nuclear weapons. So right now, tensions are boiling to the breaking point. On one hand, the United States is putting the squeeze on the North Korean economy to the point where they're beginning to feel the pinch. Energy supplies from China are being restricted, and it means that consumer goods cannot flow into Korea, creating more domestic discontent. Meanwhile, the North Koreans are accelerating their ballistic missile and nuclear capabilities, and so it's a new stalemate on a much higher level. And now we have the good news and the bad news. The good news is, are we witnessing a historic thaw between the North and the South and the United States? We had this historic visit recently between Kim Jong-un, the untested leader of North Korea, and the leader of South Korea. Very soon, within a few weeks, Donald Trump will meet with Kim Jong-un, and perhaps, just perhaps, we may be entering a win-win situation. First of all, what do the United States and North Korea have to gain by going into negotiations? Well, first of all, what North Korea apparently wants is a treaty which states that the United States will not attack North Korea. The North Koreans are not stupid. They saw what happened to Gaddafi in Libya and also Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They did not have nuclear weapons, and Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi are not here today to complain about that fact. And so the North Koreans view nuclear weapons as a security blanket. However, they may be willing to take another security blanket, and that is a treaty of some sort that pledges the United States not to attack North Korea. But then, of course, well, what does the United States have to gain from this? Well, of course, the North Koreans are going to extract increased trade agreements because, of course, their economy is on a stranglehold right now. But what does the United States want? The United States wants complete irreversible denuclearization. That was once considered impossible because the North Koreans have stated that they need nuclear weapons for self-preservation. However, now they seem to be offering a second track, that is a treaty of some sort from the United States and North Korea so that the United States will guarantee the security of North Korea. Well, that's the good news. Now, what's the bad news? The bad news is, first of all, will North Korea really abide by the treaty? In the past, the North Koreans have signed treaties, but they've cheated. The very fact that they have nuclear weapons, the very fact they have 20 to 60 atomic bombs, is a testament to the fact that they went back on UN agreements and previous treaties. The other bad news is, well, will the United States suddenly tear up a treaty and say, well, fooled you, didn't I? That's not clear. And so the question is, how reliable is the United States when it signs a treaty of non-aggression with North Korea? And then, of course, we have the wild cards. What about China? First of all, China has been a huge disappointment. We thought that perhaps China would be the key player to rein in North Korea. Well, China did restrict energy supplies to North Korea to a degree, but let's face it, 90%. Estimated that about 90% of the goods flowing into North Korea come from China. China has the cards. But you see, what does China want? China wants a buffer between them and the United States. The Chinese believe that if the United States takes over North Korea, or if the North Korean government simply collapses, then South Korea will take over, and then the United States will put troops right on the border with China. And for China, that is unacceptable. That's why China is apparently willing to put up with all the instability in North Korea, because of the fact that there could be a collapse of North Korea and troops, U.S. troops, could be stationed right next to the border. So what does China want? China wants a buffer. But you see, it could be a house of cards, because if North Korea collapses because of the sanctions, then where does your buffer go? But anyway, China has been a disappointment, but we'll still see what happens with China as the negotiations begin to heat up. Now, the pessimists say that this could be yet another cycle whereby hopes are raised and then hopes are dashed. Other people are more optimistic, and they say, well, let's give peace a chance, and who knows, maybe these key players will win the Nobel Peace Prize for doing something that has not been done for 50 years, and that is a denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So we wait and see. It's a waiting game. We'll have to wait and see what happens when Donald Trump meets Kim Jong-un. Also, news from outer space. NASA has already mapped the surface of Mars. Practically every square foot of Mars has been photographed or analyzed by our rovers. We know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the surface of the Earth, because about 3/4 of the surface of the Earth is covered with water, where the water of Mars disappeared billions of years ago, and we have a frozen desert. That's what Mars is, a frozen desert. And that's where the InSight probe comes in. It's destined to reach Mars, we hope, if all goes well, around November 26. And what do we gain? We've already mapped the surface of Mars. This time we're going to go underground. That's right, underground. But how do you measure what's happening underneath the soil of Mars? Well, take a look at a sonogram. A sonogram basically takes the vibrations within the human body and calculates the echoes where the waves bounce within our organs, and then uses computers to construct an image of what's inside our body. In the same way, the new set of space probes going to Mars will have seismographs. They're going to measure Mars quakes. So when an earthquake happens, not only can you find out where the earthquake originated from, you can also find out where the wave bounced and ricocheted inside the planet Mars. We do that with the Earth, and that gives us a rather crude map of the interior of the Earth. In the same way, by measuring Mars quakes, it may be possible to reconstruct a crude image of what's inside the interior of Mars. Now, why should we bother? Because, you see, Mars is frozen. It was frozen billions of years ago, and so in some sense, it's a time machine. It shows us what the Earth might have looked like billions of years ago, because the Earth, on the other hand, is dynamic. We have volcanoes, we have earthquakes, we have continental drift. And because the Earth is dynamic, geologically speaking, because the interior of the Earth is actually radioactive and generates heat, it means that it's very difficult to reconstruct the history of the early Earth. But Mars, hey, Mars is frozen. And so as a consequence, we may be able to answer some questions, like, for example, what happened to the water on Mars? Mars once had plenty of water. In fact, we see the outlines of what could be a primitive ocean, an ocean that once existed on Mars, about the size of the United States of America. So we know that Mars once had water, but what happened to it? Well, the atmosphere disappeared, but why? Because we think the magnetic shield around Mars disappeared. With the collapse of the magnetic field, it means that the solar wind could hit Mars and literally blow its atmosphere into outer space over a period of time, causing the atmosphere to dissipate, so that water will then boil and then be either crystallized in the form of ice or basically drift into outer space. Now, believe it or not, our magnetic field is also beginning to damp. We don't know why either, but it turns out that if you compare the magnetic field hundreds of years ago, as measured by the ancient mariners, and compare that to the magnetic field of today, you find that, yes, the magnetic field of the Earth is beginning to damp. Now, of course, we're not talking about a pole shift. We're not talking about a collapse. But yes, it turns out that over the next few centuries to next thousands of years, the magnetic field could gradually go down to zero and then maybe even migrate. For example, if you go to Hawaii and dig right into the lava, you see that the lava crystallized, preserving the direction of the magnetic north. And then as you dig deeper and deeper into the lava, you find that the direction of north shifted. Yes, the north pole of the planet Earth actually shifts. Now, does that mean the end of the Earth? No. This happens every few thousand to every few hundred thousand years. It's happened many times, the migration of the North Pole, but it is not the migration of the geologic North Pole. Many people forget this. The magnetic North Pole can, in fact, wander without causing the destruction of the Earth. However, if the geologic North Pole, around which the Earth rotates, if that were to have a pole shift, then you are talking about doomsday. Then you are talking about literally the end of the planet Earth. But as I said, that's not going to happen. So in other words, the whole point of this new set of space probes is, given the fact that we've already mapped the surface of Mars, now we want to boldly go where we've never gone before, and that is underground. And the benefit is we'll learn more about the Earth. We'll learn more about why the Earth's magnetic field is beginning to drop. We'll learn more about earthquakes, more about continental drift, more about our own planet, because Mars was frozen billions of years ago. And now I'd like to say a few things about DNA. DNA, of course, is even more reliable than fingerprints for crime scenes, but now we have yet another tool in our toolkit, and that is familiar DNA. So let me explain. First of all, if somebody commits a horrendous murder and there's plenty of DNA to go around, it may be useless if there's no match. It's like having a fingerprint that has no match in the FBI files or any other files. So we know that somebody has that DNA profile, but we don't know who. And there are a lot of cases, especially rape cases, where we do have DNA from the perpetrator, but there's no match because this person was not in the military. This person did not commit previous crimes that would warrant a DNA fingerprint. And so the authorities are basically stuck at that point if they were relying on DNA evidence. But now things have changed. Now a lot of people are volunteering to pay a certain amount of money to have their DNA read by 23andMe and Ancestry.com. Now, the case involved here is the Golden State Killer. For decades, terrorized California. I remember those days because I was in California when some of those murders took place, and they were horrendous with blood everywhere and DNA everywhere, but there was no match. And DNA technology was just coming in at that time, and there was no database. Now we have a database large enough so that not only can we match your DNA, but we can also match your family's DNA as well. That's called familial DNA. So with the Golden State Killer, there was plenty of DNA that the authorities had, but the DNA was useless because there was no match until now. Now the authorities went to GED Match, a voluntary organization for free. You can upload your DNA, and bingo. They find that there was a match to a family tree, not a specific individual, of course, but to a family tree, there was a match. And it turns out the match took place with the person's great-great-grandfather. So apparently, the Golden State Killer shared a great-great-grandfather with somebody who voluntarily submitted DNA to GED Match. Then they got the whole set of possible relatives of the Golden State Killer and matched it according to people that live in the Sacramento area. and matched it according to people who were probably in their 70s, because, of course, the last incident took place back in 1986 that the authorities know about. And by going through the files, bingo, they found a match. But you see, that's not enough, because still we're using familial DNA, not the actual DNA. So on several occasions, the authorities were able to secretly get DNA from the suspect, probably by looking through the garbage, and bingo, they found an exact match. And so that led to an arrest. And then, of course, everyone was shocked. Shocked because, well, he's our next-door neighbor. We've known him for decades, and he's the Golden State Killer. Well, in some sense, it had to be like that. You see, if this person were totally unstable and had a very reckless lifestyle, he would have been noticed decades ago. So the authorities knew that the guy was smart. He had knowledge of police tactics. He was able to evade the authorities. He never left fingerprints, but he left a lot of DNA, which, of course, was useless until familial DNA came into picture. That is, enough relatives began to voluntarily put their DNA into these files. Now, this raises certain privacy concerns, because the question is, were these people consulted when their DNA was matched with the DNA of the Golden State Killer? Well, the answer is no. However, there's a loophole here. And that is, if you take a look at the GED match contract, it says explicitly that, yes, there are circumstances where your DNA evidence might be shared to people other than you. So legally, we're now in uncharted territories. We have contracts showing that people who voluntarily donate their DNA to these DNA banks knowingly sign a document which says that they authorize other people, like the authorities, to analyze their DNA. But the question here is that enough? Well, of course, that'll be tested in the courts. But just like fingerprints, it took a while before the public got used to the idea of fingerprint matching decades ago. And then, of course, it took time for the public to get used to DNA matching. Well, it may take some more time before the public gets used to familial DNA matching. And also hitting the news, President Donald Trump has publicly stated that he's thinking about creating a space force, not just an Air Force, not just a Navy, not just an Army or a Coast Guard or the Marines. No, a new branch of the military called the Space Force, which would enforce United States foreign policy into outer space. Now, at first, you may say to yourself, wow, this means that Buck Rogers has finally come to town. Star Wars has arrived early. Think about it, militarization of outer space. Well, the first reaction of many people is, wow, we're talking about spaceships in outer space, just like in the movies. But then the reality begins to seep in. And then you begin to realize, well, there are unforeseen consequences if we create a space force. First of all, there is the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. It is a very old treaty. However, the treaty has held, and that's one reason why we have not militarized outer space. The Outer Space Treaty of 67 says that nuclear weapons shall not be placed in orbit in outer space, and it restricts the sovereignty of nations trying to take over the moon and other celestial bodies. However, there are some loopholes in the Outer Space Treaty of 67. One of the loopholes is it doesn't say anything about conventional weapons, such as, for example, laser cannons and particle beam weapons that are non-nuclear. So nuclear weapons, orbiting nuclear weapons, are forbidden by the treaty. But conventional weapons like laser cannons, like missiles, like different kinds of weapons that can impact on satellites, they are apparently allowed by the Outer Space Treaty. So in other words, there could be a new round of negotiations, perhaps at the United Nations or perhaps with the European Union, because, of course, the United States is not the only game in town. Other countries have access to outer space peacefully, And then the question is, well, what does it mean for us if we begin unilaterally arming the heavens? Well, first of all, the Chinese have an expression, never pick up a rock, only to drop it on your feet. Because first of all, who's most vulnerable if there is to be a space war? Well, obviously, it's the United States. The United States has invested heavily in telecommunications satellites, GPS satellites, you name it, we're there. And so if there is a war in outer space, who benefits and who does not benefit the most? Well, the biggest loser would be precisely the United States of America. Also, nuclear weapons, when they're detonated in outer space, behave much differently than on the Earth. On the Earth, for example, an atomic bomb may have a kill radius of maybe 10 miles or so, depending upon the impact of the weapon itself, whether it's an airburst, ground burst, how many megatons, and so on and so forth. So, roughly speaking, a kill radius of maybe 10 miles. However, in outer space, there's no air to impede the radiation, and the kill radius of a nuclear weapon could be thousands of miles. That's right. We're talking about the ability to wipe out half, almost half of all satellites orbiting the Earth with a single nuclear weapon. This is called the electromagnetic pulse. It turns out that the United States has, in fact, detonated nuclear weapons in outer space in the past. Now, it turns out that the United States has, in fact, in the past, detonated nuclear weapons in outer space with unexpected results. It turns out that the ionization created by a nuclear weapon is so severe that when it hits the atmosphere of the Earth, it disturbs the ionosphere, creating a shockwave that when it hits the Earth could cause short circuits of delicate electronic equipment. This is the electromagnetic pulse. It means that even a small nuclear power would have the ability to literally paralyze the U.S. of A. if it detonates a small nuclear weapon strategically right over the heartland of the United States. So, in other words, if we begin to introduce weapons into outer space, initially, yeah, the United States will have an advantage. But in the long term, who's most vulnerable to the electromagnetic pulse? Who's most vulnerable to having our satellites, communication satellites, wiped out? It's like in a gunfight where you have two gunslingers, where one of them gets sand and throws sand in the eyes of the enemy. So no matter how good the enemy is as a sharpshooter, the other guy can win because he can blind the other sharpshooter. And that concludes the first part of Exploration. We're talking about rockets in outer space, so in the second half of Exploration, we'll talk about, well, the most important figure in the history of rocketry, and that is Wernher von Braun. The only thing we have to point out, however, is that he was a member of the Nazi Party, and the Nazis, of course, supported the creation of Vengeance 2, the V2 weapon, the first time that rocketry was militarized to dominate a world war. So in the second half of Exploration, we'll talk about Wernher von Braun and the legacy of how far should science promote warfare. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we discussed the whole question of war and peace and the relationship between politics and technology. Given the fact that the North Koreans have fielded perhaps 20 to 60 atomic bombs, nobody really knows for sure. And second of all, they have ICBMs that could, well, reach the United States, probably not reliably. However, that's enough to become a game changer in case war breaks out. And the President of the United States has already drawn a red line in the sand, saying that he will not tolerate a North Korea that can strike at the United States reliably. And so the question for today is, well, how did it all get started? Our special guest today concerns Wernher von Braun, the father of modern rocketry. He was a man who took the sketches and diagrams and early prototypes of rockets of the past and built a truly vengeance machine, the Vengeance 2 rocket, the V2 rocket, which terrorized London and almost changed the course of World War II. And so today we're going to talk about the whole question of technology, warfare, and the scientists behind it all. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Neufeld. He's the chair of the Space History Division of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And he's the author of an exciting book. It's a huge book. It's perhaps the definitive biography of one of the pioneers in the exploration of outer space, Wernher von Braun. If you are a baby boomer, you probably were mesmerized by the image of this handsome scientist pointing the way to the stars with Walt Disney, saying, "On to the moon." And of course, he was successful that in his lifetime, he saw his childhood dream come true when he was responsible, in part, for putting several men on the moon. So once again, our special guest is Michael J. Neufeld of the Smithsonian Museum. The book is titled Von Braun, Dreamer of Space, Engineer of War, and it's also a book that forces us to confront the fact that how do we deal with scientists who work closely with the Nazis? So why rocketry? Rockets were thought to be the stuff of science fiction and toys. Why did he seize on rocketry?
You know, it was right in the 1920s that the space movement took off for the first time and reached the general public. It was because of several theoreticians. One of them was Robert Goddard in the United States. Another was Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in Russia. And then in the German-speaking world, Hermann Oberth. And in 1925 or the beginning of 1926, he already enthused by astronomy, got a hold of Oberth's rocket treatise, The Rocket in Interplanetary Space. And even though he couldn't understand it because it was all full of mathematical formulae, he was extremely excited about the idea that you could actually travel there.
Okay, now very soon he becomes head of the rocket program for the government. Exactly how was the transition done? Here we had this young kid getting interested in engineering and rocketry, and all of a sudden he becomes a pro. What happened?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Of course, it takes a number of years here, about 6 or 8 years from the time that he discovers Oberth. You know, he goes to boarding school. His math grades, which were terrible, become much better because all of a sudden he's motivated in math and science and becomes a kind of prodigy. He graduates early in 1930 from high school, goes into engineering school in Berlin. And at the same time, he was a member of the Early Rocket Society in Germany, and they built a rocket center in Berlin. And this so-called Raketenflugplatz, this rocket club in Berlin, was beginning to experiment with rockets after 1930. And in 1932, the Army, which had already been watching this, got interested again in the rocket as a weapon. The rocket, maybe the liquid fuel rocket that these clubs were developing, might actually be useful for a long-range weapon.
Now, 1933 is the pivotal year where Hitler takes over, which changed everything. So how did von Braun deal with the Nazi regime?
Well, you know, von Braun at first almost, as he says, paid almost no attention to this change of power, which, except for the fact that his father lost his job, because in fact his father had been the Minister of Agriculture for the German Reich in the last two very right-wing cabinets before the Nazis came to power, and was out of a job on the day that Hitler became chancellor. So the Nazis came to power, and they very rapidly destroyed the Weimar democratic system and established a dictatorship. But he wasn't that interested in all that, and in any case, you know, pretty rapidly they began funding the army better and better, so more money came towards him and came towards this little rocket program. At that time, just a couple of people, including himself.
Okay, and then what happened in the 30s as more and more money came available, and which led to the development of the V-1 and the V-2 rockets?
Well, in the 1930s, more money was given to rearmament, and there were people in the Army, notably General Becker, who became the head of the Army Ordnance Department, who was extremely interested in the long-range weapon and the rocket, what we now call ballistic missile, was an exotic long-range possibility. And so he began putting more and more money into rocket development. That led in 1937 to the founding of a new rocket center at Peenemünde on the Baltic Sea, and von Braun, who'd already built up a liquid fuel rocket program, then became the technical director of this rocket research station on the Baltic.
And how old was he when he assumed the head of this rocket program?
He was 25 years old. He wasn't the head. He was a technical director, mm-hmm. and the head was a military officer always. But he always was the technical head of this rocket development. And he worked for the Army, but the rocket station was actually a collaborative effort between the Air Force and the Army. And he was the head of the Army side, which went on to develop what was later called the V-2. That was the ballistic missile. They called it the A-4. It was the fourth one in their series, which became the weapon deployed at the end of the war. The V-1 was actually a completely separate weapon that he did not develop. Mm-hmm. That was a cruise missile. It was essentially a small jet airplane, which the Luftwaffe or Air Force developed during World War II.
Okay, now the question is, how did he deal with the Nazi regime? Was he aware that slave labor was used to build these gigantic rockets?
Well, you know, he was, of course, quite aware of what was going on. In 1937, they asked him to join the Nazi Party, so he said, well, okay, why not? In 1940, the SS came and pressured him to become an officer, and he asked around, and they said, I couldn't really say no, and that was partly because he didn't really have any strong moral principles other than furthering his career, and above all, going into space is what he really wanted to do. And then in 1943, the problem came up, how are we going to assemble the V-2, and who is going to do it? And there was a real manpower shortage because of the Eastern Front. And so the decision was made by others to use concentration camp labor. And then the last phase of this, and the worst of this, is that they went underground in the fall of 1943 because of an air raid on Peenemünde by the Royal Air Force. And that's when the really horrible conditions for concentration camp labor set in. And at that time, von Braun was underground. He saw the concentration camp laborers. He saw the conditions. He was involved in decision-making about using concentration camp prisoners, which means that he certainly couldn't say that he bore no responsibility for it.
Okay, now, he wasn't the only one in that position. That is, top scientists who worked with the Nazi regime, Werner Heisenberg, the man who was in charge of the German atomic bomb program, was in a very similar situation. And so the question is, were these people Nazis at heart? Did they simply join the regime and work the regime because they wanted to further science? Was it careerism? Exactly. Why did they collaborate, in fact, work and head up large parts of the Nazi war machine?
Well, in the case of Heisenberg, he was never a member of the party. He managed to evade doing that. Both of them were fundamentally came out of very conservative backgrounds, conservative families that were nationalistic. And therefore, they felt that they were working for Germany and they were working for German interests. I don't think either Heisenberg or von Braun were fundamentally believers in National Socialism in that way. Von Braun, more than Heisenberg, I think, was taken in by the Nazi regime, was somewhat enthusiastic for Hitler, and the conquests and the achievements of the Third Reich, as they appeared to be up until they started losing the war. So of the two, I would rate von Braun as probably being closer to the Nazi regime than Heisenberg, and also bearing much more responsibility, because in fact Heisenberg never headed up an A-bomb program as such, because there never really was an A-bomb program. He was just one of the key scientific leaders of a small scientific group. Von Braun was the head of thousands of people in the middle of the war. He took a major personal responsibility.
Okay, now let's talk about the engineering feat. You mentioned Robert Goddard, who built these little putt-putt rockets. Some call them almost like toys, built on liquid-fueled propulsion systems. And von Braun takes this little Goddard rocket, only a few feet long, and builds Vengeance 2. Vengeance 2 is the rocket that brought London almost to its knees. So let's talk about the engineering challenges and the successes of von Braun.
Well, there were, of course, the V2 was an enormous engineering achievement, and I must say that the long-told, oft-told story in the United States that he got his technology from Goddard is simply not true. He knew very little about what Goddard was doing, and because Goddard was extremely secretive, and in fact, it essentially was an independent line of development that came from Hermann Oberth, and through the German rocket clubs, it led to the development of this liquid fuel rocket technology. And the main challenges were, number one, just building a rocket engine much bigger than anything built before. Number two was the supersonic aerodynamics of a projectile that was going to travel at Mach 4 or 5. And finally, the hardest problem was the guidance and control, trying to guide this ballistic missile over a range of about 200 miles and hit something. And you know, as it turned out, one of its main targets was London, and another was Antwerp after Belgium was liberated in the fall of 44. Those two cities were, you know, essentially shelled by the V2 in the fall of 44 and in the first 3 months of 45. And they did have a local effect of, you know, they were demoralizing in some ways to the local residents. But in terms of effectiveness, I would actually rate them as quite ineffective. It was much more efficient to use a four-engine bomber to drop plain old gravity bombs than it was to expend the huge resources on the V2 as a way to convey what was actually only a one-ton high-explosive warhead.
And some people say that the V2 rocket was not guided very well. They simply pointed it and hoped and prayed that its guidance system would place its warhead on the streets of London.
Well, in fact, the V2 had a very sophisticated guidance system for 1944-45. It was an inertial guidance system using gyroscopic controls, using a tilt mechanism where it goes from vertical over to 45 degrees. And some versions had radio control to try to lessen the dispersion from left to right on the trajectory. But the reality was that the technology just wasn't there. So in spite of all that sophistication, the thing could barely hit a huge urban area like London or Antwerp.
Okay, now let's talk about 1945 and 46 with the collapse of the Third Reich. What did Wernher von Braun do as Russian and American troops began to converge onto Berlin?
You know, von Braun wanted to get away, and in particular, he wanted to surrender to the U.S. Army. And when he looked at the options of the Allied powers, it was clear that they wanted to get away from Stalin's Soviet Union. And Britain and France did not have the money to fund a big rocket program. And he dreamed still of going into space. Personally, he wanted to travel into space. He wanted to land on the moon. And the United States was his best hope for doing that. So he tried to put himself in the path of the U.S. Army. And in fact, he really wasn't in his power. It was mostly because of the orders of an SS general who kept moving his group around that he was lucky enough to be in a place that was overrun by the U.S. Army. And indeed, at the beginning of May 45, he surrendered to the U.S. Army.
And there's something called Operation Paperclip, in which case Nazi scientists were brought to the United States. So what was the official attitude of the United States toward captured German scientists?
Well, when von Braun surrendered, along with several other key members, including his military commander, General Dornberger, you know, the U.S. Army officers and scientists and engineers connected to the U.S. defense became very interested in the possibility of using the German Rocketeers in the States, of importing their experience, importing their technology. And it was not the only group they were interested in. They were interested in all leading scientific and engineering fields that the Nazis had invested in and had some advantages in. And so that led to a secret program to import German scientists and engineers and technicians into the United States, called Project Overcast, which was renamed Project Paperclip in 1946. And Paperclip brought over about 1,000 engineers, scientists, and technicians, and about one-eighth of those, about 125, were von Braun's group.
And also, you mentioned in your book the fact that around this time he gets married to a first cousin. Could you elaborate?
Right. He was overseas. He was already overseas in the United States since actually September 1945. He was living in Fort Bliss outside of El Paso, Texas, which is where his group was. His 120-some Germans lived for about 4 years until 1950. And he had girlfriends before, many, because he was extremely handsome, extremely charismatic. He had actually tried to marry somebody in Germany in 1943, and that fell through. And towards the end of the war, he became very interested in a very beautiful first cousin, Maria von Quistorp, who was a member of a family he was very close to. And in late 46, he wrote to her. And then now that she was 18, and asked her to marry him, and she felt the same way, and so they agreed to the engagement by mail. And he came over in March 47, guarded by U.S. Army MPs the entire time, because they were afraid of a Soviet kidnap attempt, and he was still somewhat, watched by us. Who was he? Was he loyal? Was he useful? So he actually was brought over to Germany and married her in a ceremony in Landshut, Bavaria, in March 1947.
Okay, now let's talk about 47 to 57. What was happening then? Some people think that America was sleeping while the Russians were soaring ahead with its rockets program. But what was von Braun doing between 47 and 57?
Up until 1950, he was heading this small rocket group for the U.S. Army in El Paso, and they helped to launch the V-2s in White Sands, New Mexico, nearby, they were developing a cruise missile, actually, but they had very little money, because, in fact, we weren't very interested in the arms race with the Soviet Union until after the Korean War started. And we did not invest in ballistic missile technology very heavily until 1954. And that was the year the Eisenhower administration sort of launched a crash program to build an ICBM because of the Soviet rocket developments were getting worrisome. They were getting ahead in rocket development. Now, we never quite caught up that advantage that they had built up early on after World War II, because in 1957 we were caught by surprise, to some extent, by the first ICBM that the Soviets launched, immediately followed by Sputnik when they launched the first satellite in October of 57.
Okay, now let's talk about that historic launching of Sputnik. What was the reaction of the Eisenhower administration? What was the reaction of the public when the Russians beat the pants off the United States?
The Eisenhower administration was rather calm about the whole thing, which just tended to infuriate many people in the United States even more, because we had advance warning that they would have a rocket and satellite capability, and the Eisenhower administration actually did not mind that they set the precedent that you could overfly other countries, because ultimately Eisenhower is most interested in photo reconnaissance satellites, being able to take pictures of the Soviet Union. But the public was increasingly infuriated, especially after Sputnik 2 with the dog, only 1 month after Sputnik 1, demonstrated that they had this big rocket, this big launch capability. And so over the fall of 57, the furor over the Soviets beating us got heavier and heavier. And that brought the Eisenhower administration under pressure, ultimately accepting that von Braun would be allowed to launch a satellite in addition to our official satellite program, Vanguard.
Okay, and let's talk about Vanguard. I mean, here we have the Russians launching Sputnik 1, Sputnik 2, a dog in outer space. People are hysterical. They're saying that perhaps hydrogen bombs will be raining from outer space. And the Vanguard rocket was a dud. Explain the impact of what happens when America's great hope turns out to be a dud.
Well, you know, the Vanguard program ultimately succeeded in launching satellites, so in 58 and 59, but of course it was an enormous embarrassment on December 6, 1957, when after two Soviet successes, the first Vanguard launch failed miserably on national television, went up 4 inches, cut off, fell back, and blew up. And so this was essentially the third in a series of humiliations. Although they then launched a satellite in March 57, in the meantime, von Braun and the Army got their chance, and they launched the first U.S. satellite on January 31st, 1958, Explorer.
And tell us a little bit about that, because the public impact was absolutely staggering. Here was a German come to America to launch America's hope, as the press said.
You know, by the time that von Braun was famous for launching Explorer, he was already famous for doing other things, notably for writing articles about space travel in Collier's Magazine in the early 50s, and for appearing on Disney TV shows in 1955. So he had already made himself into a famous man and had become a U.S. citizen in 1955. So he had an image with the public that many had already accepted, that he was probably our leading rocket engineer, leading American rocket engineer. So, you know, people accepted this pretty well. I mean, obviously there were always people who had questions about his Nazi past, but the Army and his own accounts of his past sort of swept the problems under the rug and tried to make him look as good as possible.
Okay, so what happens after 57? NASA gets formed, huge amounts of money is available. What happens after 57?
Right, you know, of course, 57 and the Sputnik launches us into a space race. It launches us into a race with the Soviet Union over space, which is continually fueled by, of course, one Soviet first after another. You know, the first satellite, the first dog in space, and then later on, the first thing to go into escape velocity into orbit around the sun, the first thing to hit the moon, and so on, and eventually in 1961, the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. So all of these Russian firsts only fueled this expansion of American space development. And von Braun ends up playing, of course, a very important role in that. His rocket group for the Army is transferred to NASA in 1959-60 and becomes Marshall Space Flight Center. And in the meantime, while this is happening, the Saturn program begins. Its first version of the Saturn, later called Saturn I, is designed to be a heavy lift vehicle for putting things in orbit. And, of course, ultimately after Yuri Gagarin, Kennedy decides to go to the moon, and Saturn becomes the basis ultimately for the development of the moon rocket, Saturn V.
Okay, now 1961, the Russians put the first man in orbit around the Earth. America once again has another nervous breakdown, and there's enormous pressure, as you mentioned, on Kennedy to stake out the next goal. What was the reaction of the engineers? Did they think that Kennedy was unrealistic by saying that by the end of the decade we will put men on the moon, or did they think that it was going to be easy?
Well, certainly no one thought it was going to be easy to put humans on the moon by the end of the 1960s. I mean, everyone saw that it was an enormous challenge. The reaction varied, actually, depending on who you were talking to. And I know that many of the people involved with the early Mercury program, they were just hadn't even gotten a human up yet. Alan Shepard was launched about 3 weeks after Yuri Gagarin for a little 15-minute hop. And then 3 weeks later, Kennedy announced going to the moon, and they said, my, this is really hard. Von Braun, on the other hand, having spent his lifetime promoting the idea of space travel, and actually having been part of the behind-the-scenes discussions about how to respond with Vice President Lyndon Johnson, basically was the one who told Johnson, we can build a rocket to land on the moon probably about as fast as they can. We have a very good chance of beating them to a landing on the moon.
Now, to be fair, we also have to point out that rocketry can be used, of course, both for war and for peace. Just like a hammer, just like a bow and arrow, we're talking about devices that humans make that can be used for peace as well as for war. I mean, after all, take a look at a hammer. A hammer on one hand can be used to kill other people, but on the other hand, it could be used to build cities, to build empires. And so we have to realize that, well, yes, there's a price we have to pay. But when we look at the legacy of Wernher von Braun, we have to realize that, A, he was not happy with the rise of Nazi Germany, but he went along with it and benefited from it. And second of all, afterwards, well, he took us to the moon. And he opened up the space age. I mean, think about that. Telecommunications, the internet, GPS, all the wonders of technology that we take for granted are byproducts of the space program. And the fact that we had to miniaturize technology to get on the Apollo spacecraft helped to create the microchip as we know it. And so the computer revolution, which generates trillions of dollars in income for the nations of the world, well, all that high technology, in part, came from the space program. And so we have to put things into larger perspective. We can't simply judge people by the moral standards of today. We have to put ourselves in his shoes. What would we have done if we had been faced with the choice given Wernher von Braun? Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, you've been listening to Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, and our special guest today was Michael Neufeld, author of a biography of perhaps the greatest rocket scientist of all time, and that is Wernher von Braun. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, for a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration.